This week, as I was studying and preparing in Daniel chapter 11 and 12, I started getting confused. So I did something that I haven't done on this study yet. I decided for my own benefit that I was going to do a PowerPoint to help me stay unconfused with this 11th and 12th. So, Brother Dave, if you could go over to, I think I already have it brought up there. Let me turn on my mic. This morning I had it here, but I never turned it on, so. There we are. All right. We are studying these last three chapters, and I hope that's big enough for you to see, of Daniel 10, 11, and 12. And we've already studied chapter 10, the commencement of Daniel's last vision. This was kind of the introduction to this vision. And in the first four verses of chapter 10, we had the circumstances of the vision, where it happened, when it happened, and so forth. When we came to the last part of chapter 10, we had the angel coming and everything that was going on in Daniel's life as this vision was going to be communicated to him. And so we have some of those details. The actual vision itself doesn't start until chapter 11. And so we're calling that the consummation of Daniel's last vision. And so that's chapters 11 and 12. Now, in this last vision, we have chapter 11, which is the contents of the vision, the information. And I know that we're never going to get clear through that tonight. But then the conclusion of the vision is chapter 12. So the whole 11 and 12 has to do with this final vision. Now, as I started studying this, I was confused a little bit because of the problem that occurs in chapter 10, verse 1, and chapter 11, verse 1. Did anybody have a question there as you looked at that? Let's go to Daniel, chapter 10, and chapter 11. And we can include in that chapter 9 if we want to. And chapter 9, verse 1, it says, in the first year of Darius, the son of Ahasuerus, of the seed of the Medes, and so he set his face to seek the Lord in that verse. So who's the king here? Darius. Now, when you come to chapter 10, verse 1, it says, in the third year of Cyrus, king of Persia, a thing was revealed unto Daniel. So who's king here? Cyrus. And then you go back to chapter 11, verse 1. It says, also in the first year of Darius the Mede, I stood to confirm and strengthen him. And now will I show thee the truth. Behold, and then we have the beginning of the vision. So it seems like in chapter 9 there's Darius. In chapter 11 there's Darius. But now we have Cyrus in chapter 10. How do we answer that? All right, so that he has the answer there. You notice that we have the third year of Cyrus and the first year of Darius, but it has to do with the succession of kings here that's going on. And Cyrus was the one who was the overall ruler, and after he conquered Babylon by using one of his generals, Darius, what did Darius get? He was put in charge of Babylon. So he was an under king to Cyrus. So certain things happened while that under king was going taking place. But Cyrus, the overall king, was in his third year when Darius was in his first year. So there's no conflict here at all. It's just who is ruling over the province of Babylon and who's ruling over the whole kingdom of the Medes and Persians. And it's not too long after this that actually Darius dies. He was already in his 80s, and he only ruled for a short while, and he died, and then Cyrus took over ruling again, even Babylon. So there's really no conflict here between who's ruling at the particular time at all. Now, to understand this prophecy, we have to understand that this is primarily a prophecy about Greece. Greece is the primary one who's in control during the time that this prophecy takes place, or will be in control. It's a prophetic vision of, and especially is it important to Daniel, because he's inquiring, how is all of this Gentile rule going to affect Israel? And so keep in mind that this vision particularly has as its theme how the Gentile nation of Greece is going to have an impact upon Israel. That's the main content of this vision. But he has some preparation for that time. He doesn't just jump in to the middle of this. And so at the time that Daniel is having this vision, who is in control? What major world power is in control? The Medes and the Persians are under Cyrus. All right, so he gives us this information. And then there are three more kings of Persia that are the next three after Cyrus. Let's look at verse 2 of this, of Daniel 11. It says, "And now will I show thee the truth. Behold, there shall stand up yet three kings in Persia, and the fourth shall be far richer than they all, and by his strength, through his riches, he shall stir up all against the realm of Grecia." So we have these two major kingdoms, Persia and Greece, and he's telling us that there's going to be a succession of three kings, and then there's going to be a fourth king, and that fourth king is going to do something to stir up Greece. And so that's what this first part of this vision is. And so you'll see up here on the screen that those next three rulers after Cyrus are a man by the name of Cambyses, and you see that right there. And in Ezra 4:5, when that whole scenario is going on, there's a succession of something that happens between here and here in Ezra's message, and it's during the time that Cambyses is ruling. That's the time. Then another one followed Cambyses, whose name was Smerdis. But there was a Smerdis that was the brother of Cambyses. But to make it clear, historians tell us that this was not the one who was the brother, this Smerdis. In fact, he went into office making everybody think he was the brother, and it was fake. And he was assassinated after they found out that he was not really the brother, and he only ruled for a very short period of time. And then we have another man, not the same Darius that we have been looking at here, but another one who had that first name, Darius, and they put in the last name, Hystaspes, just so we would know that it's separate, a different one. So he got kind of a second name there as well. So those are the three kings that, according to Daniel 11:2, these are the three Persian kings, and then one fourth rich king. And that fourth rich king, it says there in verse 2, he's going to be far richer than they all, and by his strength through his riches he shall stir up all against the realm of Grecia. Now, if you've studied at all the story of Esther, and you'll see I have a reference up here to Esther 1:1, who was the king at the time that Esther and Mordecai were in Syria or Persia here, who was the king? Xerxes, who's also had a second name, what's Ahasuerus. And so it's Xerxes, Ahasuerus, who is this fourth king now. And so you see how some of the books of Ezra, Nehemiah, and Esther fit into this whole story that's going on here as well. And so you have this king. And remember, why did Esther become queen? Under this guy. because Vashti said, uh-uh. And so she was replaced. But also, Xerxes came home from a battle, licking his wounds. Do you know what battle that was? With the Grecians, and he lost. And he came home licking his wounds and needed a queen to comfort him when he got home from losing this battle. And that was all part of this. This is the man, this fourth rich king that's mentioned here in chapter 2, verse 2, or 11, verse 2. This is the king that has come home and he has strengthened himself and he has all these banquets to try to show how powerful he is and how rich he is. And then he's wanting to form an army to go out and expand his kingdom. And one of the places they're going to attack is Greece. And he loses. And so then we see that a new king takes over. And who is this great? Notice verse 3. And a mighty king shall stand up that shall rule with great dominion and do according to his will. And that verse 3 is talking about Alexander the Great. And so this is Alexander the Great now, who is the one king, this prince of Greece, who now has come onto the world scene and very quickly takes over the old Persian Empire and so forth. And then verse 4 says, and when he shall stand up, meaning when he's kind of at his strongest, his kingdom shall be broken and shall be divided toward the four winds of heaven. Now, we studied this when we were looking back in chapter 7 and 8 of Daniel, that once Napoleon is out of the way, four of his generals take over and rule in the country. And they kind of split up the country into this said four winds of heaven. You're talking about east, west, north, south, the four winds of heaven. And so they divide up his kingdom. And here you'll see these four generals. Their names were Cassandra, Lysimachus, Seleucia, and Ptolemy. So you have Cassandra that was in Europe, Macedonia, Greece. This was Asia Minor, Syria and Babylon, and Egypt and North Africa. So the whole kingdom gets split up into four kingdoms, kind of. And they get along for a while. But then verse 4 says and shall be divided toward the four winds of heaven and not to his posterity. Whose posterity? Alexander the Great. It's not going to go to any of his sons or anyone that they're going to rule. Not to his posterity, nor according to his dominion which he ruled, for his kingdom shall be plucked up even for others besides those. And so it's giving us a little history about what's going on here. So note now, we have one kingdom, the kingdom of Greece, but four regions within that kingdom. And notice what happens then in this division. Look at verse 5. And the king of the south shall be strong. Now, I want to just give you a little hint. Whenever Daniel refers to king of the south, king of the north, he is doing that in reference to Israel. So a king that's north of Israel and a king that's south of Israel. So he's talking about a king that would be in the north, which what country is kind of north of Israel? Syria. What kingdom is kind of south of Israel? Egypt. So he's talking about Egypt and Syria here. So when he says in verse 5, and the king of the south shall be strong, who's that? Well, maybe Ptolemy here. If we go back a slide, Ptolemy, who's this king in Egypt now, he's strong. And one of his princes, and he shall be strong above him and have dominion. His dominion shall be a great dominion. And the end of years, they shall join themselves together. Who's that joining himself together? Well, if you read on, it says, and in the end, they shall join themselves together, for the king's daughter of the south shall come to the king of the north to make an agreement. So these two kings, Seleucus and Ptolemy are going to do what? Try to form an alliance by doing what? Intermarrying. I'll give you my daughter, you give me your son, we'll have, and then we'll get along. You know? And so they tried to perform this alliance, and it says, verse 6, and make an agreement, but she shall not retain the power of the arm, neither shall he stand nor his arm, but she shall be given up, and they that brought her, and he that begat her, and he that strengthened her in these times. So who's going to get betrayed here? The king of the south, as he brought his daughter up, he's going to get betrayed by Syria. And then it says, but out of a branch of her root shall one stand up in his estate, which shall come with an army, and shall enter into the fortress of the king of the north, and shall deal against them and shall prevail. So after this alliance broke down, then descendants of this princess of Egypt, some of those descendants say, hey, they got strong again, and so they went back north and said, we're going to get even with this Seleucus in Syria. And so were they victorious? Yes, it says, verse 7, and shall prevail. So notice that we have this fourfold division, and we have a feeble division. It wasn't very strong. It was never as strong as when Napoleon was Alexander the Great, was in control. It was never that strong, and there was fighting going on in this division. Notice we skip down to verse 11. It says, and the king of the south shall be moved with choler. What's choler? Anger. He is going to get mad. It says, and the king of the south shall be moved with anger and shall come forth and fight with him, even with the king of the north. And he shall set forth a great multitude, but the multitude shall be given into his hand. So we've got these battles going on. This one's invading. This one's counteracting. Once they are defeated, they strengthen themselves and get back in the battle. But may I remind you, who is it that's really suffering during this time? Israel. Because where do armies from Syria have to go to get to Egypt? Through Israel. If an army from the south in Egypt wants to invade the army up in the Syria, where do they have to cross through? And they weren't kind when they went through with to the Jews. They treated the Jews very harshly, and what do armies need? Food. And what do armies need? Wood. That's part of the reason why Israel became such a barren land, because these armies that would pass through kept cutting all the trees. And so it was devastating to Israel. And so why is Daniel having a vision about this? Because this is going to affect Israel, these battles that are going on here in chapter 11. And so we have this fighting that takes place here, and we have this king of the north versus the king of the south. Again, always in reference to Israel, north Syria, south Egypt, fighting with each other. They tramp across Israel. Israel's caught in the middle. Israel's caught in the crossfire. All right? Now, we have a couple of things that are trying to take place here. We've already looked at the adversaries in the fighting, the king of the north, the king of the south. We have these alliances. We talked about one of them in verse 6 already. That didn't work. So they tried another alliance. Look in verse 17. He shall also set his face to enter in with strength of his whole kingdom and upright ones with him. Thus shall he do, and he shall give him the daughter of women, corrupting her. But she shall not stand on his side, neither be for him. So they try a second marriage alliance. Both attempts at trying to reach peace failed. You know, and we know from history there's never going to be peace unless what? The Prince of Peace is the one who brings it. Nation can rise against nation. They can make all kinds of peace treaties. They can, and we're going to see that in the end times too, aren't we? We're going to see these alliances. We're going to see these peace treaties. We're going to see these covenants. But they're all going to be broken because the Prince of Peace is not here. So Then we have, so we have the adversaries, we have the alliances, we have the attacks in verses 7 to 9. And notice what this fighting involved. Let's just see, look for some key words. Verse 8, and they shall carry captives into Egypt with their gods and their princes and with their precious vessels of silver. So there's captives, there's wealth that's going to be taken from Syria back down into Egypt. And then it says, and he shall continue more years than the king of the north. So the king of the south shall come into his kingdom, and he shall return into his own land. But his sons shall be stirred up, and shall assemble multitude great forces. And one shall certainly come and overflow and pass through. Then shall he return and be stirred up even to his fortress. And the king of the south shall be moved with choler. So there's anger going on here. And there's great armies that are being described here in verses 10 and 11. Multitudes, they're called, verse 11. And great forces, multitude of great forces in verse 10. And then we see that we're even shown the areas of the fighting. So we have the adversaries, the alliances, the attacks. We have the areas of fighting. Where's it going to happen? Well, look at verse 16 and verse 41. They talk about the glorious land. Look at verse 16. But he that cometh against him shall do according to his own will, and none shall stand before him when he shall stand in the glorious land, which by his hand shall be consumed. So what's going to happen to Israel, the glorious land? They're going to be consumed. Notice verse 41. It talks about the glorious land. He shall enter also into the glorious land, and many countries shall be overthrown. But these shall not escape out of his hand, even Edom and Moab and the chief of the children of Ammon. So in war, there are casualties. And sometimes it's people who haven't even been in the battle. They're the ones that suffer. And the glorious land is going to suffer here because of these battles going on between this Grecian Empire, but segments of the Grecian Empire, especially Syria and Egypt. And so you see, and then verse 18 mentions isles. Well, these are some of those coastal islands in the Mediterranean, as well as the very coastal lands. They are often referred to as the isles. And so some of the nations that are along the coast there, Lebanon and others, are going to suffer as well because of all this fighting that's going to take place. And then we come down to verse 20, and it says, well, let's read to get there. Let's go start at verse 14. And in those times there shall many stand up against the king of the south. Also the robbers of thy people shall exalt themselves to establish the vision, but they shall fail. So the king of the north shall come and cast up a mount and take the most fenced city. So what's happening here? For a while, the king of the south, Egypt, was in control. But then the north finally says, we're strong enough, we're going to attack. And when it says they build a mount, what do you think it means to build a mount? A fort? Or there? Sometimes it's talking about building a ramp like they did at Masada to besiege the city and conquer the city. So a city would have a big wall. There's only one way you get over the wall. You either build a mountain high enough so you can shoot down. So you build this huge, huge mound of dirt called a mountain here. And now you're higher than they are. So you can shoot down. Or you use it to build a ramp so that you can conquer the city. So we're looking at campaigns that last sometimes for years here. And so he's doing that. Verse 15, the king of the north shall come and cast up a mount and take the most fenced cities, and the armies of the south shall not withstand, neither his chosen people, neither shall there be any. But, and who are the chosen people here? The Jews. So verse 15 talks about his chosen people. They're not going to stand either. They're not going to be able to withstand this. And verse 16 But he that cometh against him shall do according to his own will, and none shall stand before him, and he shall stand in the glorious land which by his hand shall be consumed. So here's part of this vision of Daniel showing how this battle that's going to take place is going to affect the land of Israel. It's going to consume it. Now, verse 17, he shall also set his face to enter with the strength of his whole kingdom, and upright ones with him. Thus shall he do, and he shall give him the daughter of women, corrupting her, but she shall not stand at his side, neither be for him. That was another alliance that didn't work. After this shall he turn his face unto the isles, and shall take many. But a prince for his own behalf shall cause the reproach offered by him to cease. Without his own reproach he shall cause it to turn unto him. Then he shall turn his face toward the fort of his own land, and he shall stumble and fall and not be found. So what's going to happen? Some of his own people are going to turn against him, and he's going to be conquered here. And so we're looking at all of this fighting that's going on. And so we looked at the fighting in the divisions, chapter 11, verse 11. Now we come through a succession of various rulers that have happened, and they replace in there. We don't have them all that we're going to name tonight, but there's a succession of some rulers until we come to verse 20. Then shall stand up in his estate a raiser of taxes in the glory of the kingdom, but within few days he shall be destroyed, neither in anger nor in battle. We don't know exactly what happened to him, but here's a guy coming along and says, boy, I'm going to start raising taxes because we need more money to go back to war. And the people didn't put up with that. Now we're introduced in verse 21 to the fiend in the divisions. What's a fiend? Somebody who's very... What's the word that verse 21 uses to describe this particular king coming on the scene? He's vile. He's vile. So now we've come through these... What kind of kings? Grecian kings of the kingdom of Greece. And now we're going to come to one in particular who, after all these internal struggles in the kingdom of Greece, things settle down and one guy is going to take over, and he is vile. He is so vile. And it says in verse 21, to whom they shall not give the honor of the kingdom. They're not going to willingly elect him as king, but he shall come in peaceably and obtain the kingdom by flatteries. So we've got this one. Now, again, in studying history, we determine and learn that the one who did that is a man called Antiochus Epiphanes. He's the one who comes in here in verse 21 as this vile, contemptible, disdained ruler. And you know what Epiphanes means? It means manifestation of God. That was his self-appointed name. He said, I am Antiochus, manifestation of God. But he was so vile that his own people gave him a nickname. They called him Epimenes. Not Epiphanes, but Epimenes. And that means madman. So he's calling himself a manifestation of God. What are they calling him? A madman. And there's more attention now given to this king. Notice, we've gone through all these different kings from chapter 2 down through verse 21. We've had all of these various kings, and we've gone over them rapidly, and now we come to who? Antiochus Epiphanes, and guess what? The whole rest of the chapter is devoted to him. The whole rest of the chapter. Why? Anyone know why that all of this is now, I have the question here, more attention given to this king than all the others. Why? Because of what Antiochus Epiphanes does in relationship to Israel. He particularly does a lot of things very dastardly and very devastating and for the nation of Israel. And the other reason that he's given such attention here is because he is a very, very, very strong picture of the Antichrist. And he's a type of the Antichrist. And so that's why there is so much attention given here to Antiochus Epiphanes, because of how terrible he was toward Israel and how terrible his antitype, the fulfillment of his type, will be one day to Israel as well. And so as we read, and it'll start next Sunday night with our continued study of Antiochus Epiphanes, remember that we are going to also be looking at the characteristics that will be found in the Antichrist as well. There was a literal Antiochus Epiphanes, and his antitype, Antichrist, will have many of the same characteristics that Antiochus Epiphanes had. And you know why? Because Antiochus Epiphanes was controlled by Satan. So he's going to have several of the same characteristics as the eventual Antichrist will have, because he too will be controlled by Satan. And so then we've come this far to the fighting, the fiend, and now we're going to look at this fiend, and notice that's going to be our study next week, as far as how this fiend called Antiochus Epiphanes, or Epimenes, the madman, is going to have an effect on Israel, not only back then, but in his anti-type, in the person of the Antichrist. We'll be seeing some truth here that is both factual and prophetic at the same time. I know I went through that quickly. Was it as clear as mud? I needed this to keep me thinking who was who and where was this one and where was that one. I hope it was helpful for you tonight too. Any questions? That means you all understand perfectly, right? All right. You know what? Let's just make one application tonight before we leave. Aren't you glad that God knows the beginning from the end? And all of these things were prophesied hundreds of years before they happened. Didn't take God by any kind of surprise. God knew all this was going to take place. And it's not going to take God by surprise when some of these things happen again in the future with the Antichrist. And so we can rest assured that our God knows and our God's in control. And we don't have to fret. We don't have to worry. We don't have to be concerned, because our God does all things well. And he's in control, and we can trust him. Let's turn in our hymn books tonight, and we'll come back to